All right, Genesis chapter 39. We left off, went through Genesis chapter 36, 37, and 38. We talked about Esau and his offspring in Genesis chapter 36. We didn't go into great detail. We didn't read through all of the names, but we did look at some of the countries that came out of that. We did look at the ties between Ishmael and Esau. We looked at the fact that Ishmael himself was known as the archer, the guy who carried the bow. We see in Revelation chapter 6, the rider on the white horse is coming out with a bow. And just because he's riding on a white horse does not mean he has a white hat like you see in the Westerns. He's not a good guy. We see somebody else riding on a white horse a little later on in Revelation. That's Jesus. He's the good guy. But we covered some of that. And then we went into Genesis 38, or 37 and 38, and we dealt with Judah and a couple of his sons. Well, actually three. You remember their names? Onan and Shelah. We know that married a woman by the name of Tamar. He died. And then Judah, according to their custom, gave Onan to Tamar, or Tamar to Onan. And Onan was supposed to go in, take her as wife, but the offspring that came out of her would belong to his dead brother. What did Onan do? Onan went in, practiced the withdrawal method. Instead, he spilled his seed on the ground. God got angry at him because he was not fulfilling what he was supposed to do. And so he was killed. And the next in line was supposed to be Shelah, or Shelah. And Judah looked at him and said, you know, I don't think I want to give my son to her, my third one, because look what's happened to the other two. But he did promise Shelah to Tamar, and he broke the promise. And Tamar had to go back to her parents' home, live there as a widow during a period of time. And Judah just did not fulfill the promise to her. So she changed out of her widow's garments, as you may recall, and she went and she ran into Judah, as was her plan. And Judah looked at her and thought that she was a prostitute. She wasn't a prostitute, but he thought she was, and he was willing to pay her a goat for her services. And while that was fine, she said, no, I need a promise from you. You've got to give me something. So he got the signet ring, the cords, and his staff. He got her pregnant, and it was revealed to him a few months later, hey, your daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant. She's been playing the harlot as a widow. And of course, Judah was very compassionate, right? No, he wasn't. He said, let's take her out and burn her to death. Not good. Swift justice or swift injustice during those days. But she said that the man who got me pregnant, these things belonged to him, and it turned out to be his stuff. And so he said, Tamar's more righteous than I am, and the story almost ends there, except she got pregnant and had twins. We see a lot of twins run in the family. And we see that she had a couple of kids. The first one came out, stuck his hand out, and they tied a crimson string around it. And the crimson in that was made of something I talked about yesterday. You know, in Psalm 22, I think it's either verse 4 or verse 6, Jesus is speaking. He says, I am a worm. And that Hebrew word is a toloth. And the toloth is this type of insect. It's not truly a worm. It looks like a beetle or a potato. Remember those old potato beetles that kind of roll up? And it's like that, only a little bit bigger. And the female, when the female matures, she loses her legs. But she crawls up on a tree and she'll hang over a branch, the sign of a cross. She'll lay her eggs on the branch. She'll cover them. And then she will die and her body will burst forward, giving off this crimson dye, which is the same crimson dye that was used on that string that they tied around. It's the same crimson dye that is very, very valuable. And it's interesting, if it is not harvested right away, shortly after that, the crimson dye will turn white as snow. And so we see Jesus on the being crucified, saying, I am a worm. I'm a Coxus acillus, I believe the name is. I'm a worm. He's talking about those types of characteristics that he has. And of course, once the children are born, they eat the body, which should remind you, of course, take, eat, this is my body. It's not just the bread, but it's representative of what took place there. And I only bring that up because of that crimson thread that happened to be mentioned. And I know that's a bit of a detour, but I'm hopeful that all of you are going to get on Trivia Pursuit someday or on Jeopardy or something, and you'll be able to answer all of these questions. All right? So take note of that. Anyway, we then see that Joseph, the favorite son of his father, Israel, gets this very colored coat, or a coat with sleeves, actually. He gives a couple of prophecies in Genesis chapter 37, both dealing with the fact that eventually his brothers and his mother and father are going to bow down to him. The most important one, of course, is I saw a woman, sun and the moon and 11 stars bowing down to me. And of course, Joseph would have been the 12th star. And they ask him about that. What do you mean? Your mother and I are going to bow down to you, and your brothers are going to bow down to you? And of course, the interpretation of that, which is given by Israel, is the interpretation that is necessary to take in Revelation chapter 12, when we see this sign in the heavens. This is the sign of Christ's return. A woman clothed with the sun and the moon and the stars. So it's Israel. And that's important to note, because when we get to Revelation 12 and Revelation chapter 13, all the attention is on the nation of Israel. And you'll see that throughout. In fact, even earlier. But we're going to be looking at the sign of his return. Now, the brothers of Joseph decided they wanted to kill him. And of course, they were going to take him. They were going to dump him down in this cavern, or this dry cistern, whatever it was. They were going to toss him down there. He wouldn't be able to get out, and he would die. His brother Reuben stepped in with a plan to rescue him. His brother Judah eventually stepped in and said, hey, he's our own flesh and blood. Let's not kill him. Let's sell him instead. It's what every brother wants to hear. So they sell him to this caravan from Canaan that goes down to Egypt, and he eventually ends up there. And it's something that we would think is a bad thing, but it's not a bad thing. God causes all things to work together to those who believe, who love God and are called according to his purpose, as it says in Romans chapter 8. And Joseph is living proof of that. You'll see that this bad stuff that had happened to him ultimately will lead to good and save the entire Hebrew race, in essence, at that particular time. So we won't go any further than that. We'll start off in chapter 39, since I've taken up 10 or 15 minutes of your time, and I apologize for that. I'm going to take a quick sip of water. You don't all have to turn and look, Deanna. All right, chapter 39, verse 1. Let's continue on. It says, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, brought him from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down from there. So the Ishmaelites were technically the Canaanites, because Ishmael married into that group, as well as Esau did. And the caravan brought him down there, sold him to Potiphar, and Potiphar, of course, was one of the captains of the guards, bodyguards for the Pharaoh. And the Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And if you're going to be a successful man, it's great to have the Lord with you, right? Because he needs or deserves the credit. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And it's interesting that, I'll tell you this later. We'll hold on. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. See, when God's with you, people take notice. And God was with Joseph, and and they were taking notice. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. This is much like when Daniel was taken into captivity in Babylon. You know, he became one of the third rulers of the kingdom because God was with him, and it's noticeable. They're very productive people. So all that he owned was put in his charge, and it came about that from that time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, and the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Now, was the Egyptian a believer in Yahweh? No, but he was still blessed because of the one in his house who was Joseph. Okay? Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So Potiphar, he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. In other words, it was all up to Joseph what happened with anything except for the food that Potiphar ate. The end of verse 6. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, which can often get you in trouble. And he's probably about 20 years or so of age at this time. And keep in mind what happens to a male or female body as they go through their teenage years and they get into their 20s. Their hormones are raging, right? And despite that, Joseph does something interesting. It came about after these events in verse 7 that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me," which apparently was a very common practice in Egypt. And Joseph here, you know, with all the hormones flowing through him, you might think, well, the master's not around, I could do this. But he's a righteous man. He's a godly man. And he does not respond this way. He takes his position seriously, and it's not the position she wanted to put him in. He is serving Potiphar, and he loves the Lord. Verse 8, but he refused, and he said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge." He's not concerned about leaving Joseph with his wife. You know, like Rush Limbaugh used to say that I'm the guy that you could trust your wife and kids in a Motel 6 over a weekend alone, that type of thing. Well, I don't think that's probably true. You could trust Joseph. He's taken this very seriously. He does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he's put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? And isn't that interesting? It's not just a sin against Potiphar. Adultery is a sin against God and against one's own body, as it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. She then speaks, verse 10, as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he did not listen. In other words, she's coming on to him repeatedly, day after day after day, trying to wear him down. And he did not listen to her to lie with her, lie beside her or be with her. He wouldn't even lay down beside her, which is smart, because things tend to happen when you do that. He wasn't going to be anywhere near her. And now as it happened one day, in verse 11, that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. And she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And this is an adamant command in the Hebrew. "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. So she pulled off his garment. They typically wore some type of robe or something similar to a toga, and he escaped naked. And it's interesting, we see in the New Testament that we are to do what Joseph did. We're to flee every appearance of evil. We resist the devil and he will flee from us, but when it comes to evil, we are to flee from it. And that is exactly what Joseph did, even running away naked. Verse 13, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed." The only lying going on there is hers, coming out of her mouth. So she decides to punish Joseph for shunning her. And this takes a heavy toll on Joseph. It actually cost him a lot. Verse 15, when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Now, she laid it beside her. She grabbed it, she laid it beside her. She wants him condemned. You've heard the expression, hell hath no fury, like a woman scorned. It kind of comes from this particular passage. Verse 17, then she spoke to him with these words. She's speaking to Potiphar. The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came into me to make sport of me. And as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside. And now when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, his anger burned. Understandable, right? Perfectly all right for him to be upset. It's misplaced, but it's based on the lie of his wife. So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. And the jails in Egypt are much like the jails in Mexico. You don't want to be there. They're not clean. They're not comfortable. They're not there to make you comfortable. They're there to punish you every single day that you happen to be in there. He was there in the jail, verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail. Isn't it interesting? God's with him wherever. Potiphar gives him everything in his house. The jailer says, hey, you're in charge of all the prisoners here as well. So that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. Of course, this might be a clever ploy to make Joseph responsible for anything wrong that happens there, but it didn't. And the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. Then it came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. We don't know exactly what their offense was, but they offended him. And if you offended the king or the pharaoh, you got either beheaded, hung out to dry, or some other torture, you got tossed into jail. Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time, for quite a while these things that they allegedly did were being investigated. Then the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in jail, both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream and each dream with its own interpretation. And when Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. You know, dream interpretation was a big thing back then. They wanted to know what it meant. He asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today, or why is your countenance fallen? And then they said to him, we have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it. And then Joseph said to me, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. So he's just one step down below Daniel. Daniel didn't even have to have the dream told to him. God gave Nebuchadnezzar's dream to him, let him know what it was. But Joseph asked them for their dream, and then he'll interpret it. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. And now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Okay, good. Then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Would any of you have guessed that? No. Three branches are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. In other words, you're restored back to the exact same position you had before. You're going to be his cupbearer. Only keep in mind what goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. He wants out of the jail. He wants out of Potiphar's house. He wants other things, better things. It says, for I was in fact kidnapped from the land of Hebrews, and even here I've done nothing that they should have put me into the dungeon. And when the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, and not just that he had interpreted, notice, he interpreted favorably, so maybe he'll give me a favorable interpretation as well. When the chief baker saw that he interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And on the top basket, there were some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. And typically, whenever you see birds in Scripture, what does it mean? It means evil, demonic, something along those lines. Typical birds, unless you're talking about a dove, you're typically seeing evil, something evil or demonic. So, top there were all sorts of baked foods for Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. Then Joseph answered and said, this is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you, and you will hang on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off of you. This is not a favorable interpretation, but it is an accurate interpretation. Verse 20, thus it came about on the 3rd day. And notice how the Bible really likes 3 days so often. It's sort of like the two thieves on the cross, it just reminds me of. While they weren't there for 3 days, they're tied to Jesus' 3 days. One ends up in a bad place, and the other ends up in paradise with Jesus. Something similar happening with these guys. Not to the same degree, but just as a type. Then it came about, or thus it came about, on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office and put the cup on Pharaoh's, into Pharaoh's hand. And he put the cup. But he hanged the chief baker just as Joseph had interpreted them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Now you would think he should have remembered Joseph, right? Joseph gave him this favorable interpretation that turned out to be exactly right. And I don't know about you, but it would bring it to remembrance to me. Wait a second, I was just talking to this guy and he told me exactly what was going to happen to both of us. Now it happened at the end of 2 full years. 2 full years. Joseph's been there for a while. That Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he was standing by the Nile. And lo, from the Nile there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed in the marsh grass. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them from the Nile, ugly and gaunt, and they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. 2 different types of cows, some healthy, some not so healthy. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 cows, sleek and fat cows. Then Pharaoh awoke. So you got the dream? 7 fat cows, healthy, 7 thin cows, unhealthy. The thin ones eat up the fat ones. Pharaoh woke and he fell asleep and he dreamed a second time. And behold, 7 ears of ears of grain came up on a single stalk, plump and good. Then behold, 7 ears, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. The thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump and full ears. Then Pharaoh woke and behold, it was a dream. Does anybody have something other than ears? In some translations, it will say ears of corn. And they weren't corn. Back in that time, the top of the wheat stalks, the very top, the fluffy part, would be called the corn or the kernel of the wheat. It's not corn, but this, again, just in case you get on Jeopardy, you will know.
Sweet berries.
Yeah.
Is it the wheat berries?
Yeah. And they would call that the corn. Okay. All right. Verse 6, then behold, 7 ears thin and scorched by the east wind sprouted up after them. The thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump and full ears. Then Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Now in the morning, his spirit was troubled, much like Nebuchadnezzar's was in Daniel chapter 2. So he sent and called for the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Anybody in this room, not having read ahead, could you interpret this? No, I couldn't interpret it. Joseph could because God gives him the interpretation. Verse 9, then the chief cupbearer, he remembers him 2 years later. He's going to remember Joseph. He spoke to Pharaoh saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Things that I did wrong, or my own sins, literally. Pharaoh was furious with his servants, and he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. We had a dream on the same night, he and I, each of us, dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. And now a Hebrew youth was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard, and we related them to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream. And just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me in my office, but he hanged him. All right? So he's going back. Pharaoh will remember these events, except for the intervention of Joseph interpreting the dream. But they're telling him there is somebody who can interpret these, and he's in prison. So then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph. And they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon, and when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, in other words, he's got to look presentable, he came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I have heard it said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Now would be a great time for the average person to step forward and say, you're darn right, I can interpret it. I have all these nice powers, which we see very typical nowadays in some of the movements that we see in the church with the false prophets, but Joseph doesn't do that. Joseph then answered in verse 16, saying, it is not in me, God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. In other words, it has nothing to do with me. If there is an interpretation here, it's going to come from God. And you notice the similarity between Joseph and Daniel here. Daniel basically said the same thing. It is God that gave him the interpretation. So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, in my dream, behold, I was standing on the bank of the Nile. And behold, 7 cows, fat and sleek, came up out of the Nile, and they grazed in the marsh grass. And lo, 7 other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such as I had never seen for ugliness in all the land of Egypt. Have you ever seen a cow that is starving? They really do look awful. All their bones are visible. I mean, they just look like they could fall over dead at any given time. Terrible thing. And the ugliness in all the land of Egypt. And the lean and ugly cows ate up the first 7 fat cows. Of course, they were hungry, but an odd behavior for vegetarians. Yet when they had devoured them, it could not be as detected that they had devoured them. In other words, it didn't make any difference. They didn't gain any weight. Which will start giving you a sense of the interpretation coming. For they were just as ugly as before. Then I awoke. I saw also my dream, and behold, 7 ears full and good came up on a single stalk, and lo, 7 ears withered, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 good ears. Then I told it to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me. Not surprised. And now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years. We all guessed that, right? I didn't. Well, I know now. I've read the story. But you don't get that interpretation necessarily. But that's what it is. The 7 good cows are 7 years. And the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one and the same, only different characters. The 7 lean and ugly cows that come up after them are 7 years. And the 7 thin ears scorched by the east wind will be 7 years of famine. It is, as I have spoken to Pharaoh, God has shown to Pharaoh what he's about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming to the land of Egypt, thus the 7 fat cows. And after them, 7 years of famine will come, and all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. So the abundance will be unknown in the land because of that subsequent famine, for it will be very severe. In other words, they're going to forget the good times. They're going to be looking at the pandemic. Wait, that's a different time, right? They're going to be looking at what is going on with the famine. And it won't be a toilet paper shortage. It's going to be a food shortage. Which is, you know, you could get by for a brief period of time, but 7 years wiped out, that's rough. We could see a lot of lives lost during that. Verse 32, now, as for the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, it means that the matter is determined by God, and God will quickly bring it about. And that ought to remind you of the word verily. You ever hear verily, verily? It's repeated twice, and that means the matter is settled. It is true. It's going to come about and happen. That is, if God says it or if Jesus says it, verily, 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 I say unto you, matters twice. It's set in stone. And God will quickly bring it about. Verse 33, now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. And let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. And typically in Egypt at that time, the tax was 10%. If it's a fifth, he's saying double it, make it 20% that they're going to have to bring in. And it's not just for the Pharaoh's use. They're going to put this in the granaries, etc. They're going to have the fruit and stuff saved for these lean times. store up the grain for... Then let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority and let them guard it. I wish somebody had guarded the toilet paper. Let the food become as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which will occur in the land of Egypt so the land will not perish during the famine. Now, see, this could have caught them unaware. They could have just eaten all the crops during that 7 years and then hit the famine and Egypt would have been wiped out. It wiped out most of the land of Canaan. In fact, that is why we'll see later on that Joseph's brothers have to come down into Egypt. What are they looking for?
Food.
They need food. And they were in such desperate need of it, their father sent them there. Okay, verse 37. Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. And then Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit? Well, he's standing right there in front of you, Pharaoh. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and as wise as you. You shall be over my house, just like he had been over Potiphar's house. And isn't it amazing this guy that went to jail is now going to be over all of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh in this particular case? God causes all things to work together for good. Were you going to say something, Don?
I remember Joseph's dream that he told to the brothers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All tying together. These dreams and their interpretations. Okay, verse 40. You shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you. This guy fresh out of jail. Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I've set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And for this, he could seal things officially, put the mark of Pharaoh on, whether it's correspondence or anything else. Joseph's in charge of it. He clothed him in garments of fine linen and put the gold necklace around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot, and they proclaimed before him, bow the knee. And he set him over all the land of Egypt. Not bad for a kid that at the age of 17 got sold into slavery, right? Still a young man here. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. So his authority really extends beyond Egypt. I mean, it stops at the border, but at the border, anybody coming in has to be brought before Joseph. They cannot come into the land unless they are brought before him. And that, of course, plays into God's hand. God destined this because his plan was to get all of his brothers in front of Joseph. And we're going to see that happen. So they've got to bring them to Joseph. Verse 45 says, then Pharaoh named Joseph Zaphnath-Paneah, or Paneah, which means God speaks. And he gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land. And that On is Heliopolis, there in Egypt. So he's got a wife given to him by Pharaoh. Now, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh. Does this remind you of anybody else? How old was Jesus when he started his ministry? 30. You see these types throughout the Old Testament? They repeat. So he's 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. And during the 7 years of plenty, the land brought forth abundantly, just as Joseph had declared through the Holy Spirit speaking through him. So he gathered all the food of these 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt and placed the food in the cities. He placed in every city the food from its own surrounding fields. That's wise, because when the famine hits, it's going to be a short distance for them to go get food. That's smart thinking. He placed in every city the food from its own surrounding fields. Then Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. They had a lot of it. And see, in a normal year, they'd give 10%. This was not just an abnormal year because they gave 20%, but the harvest itself was more and more abundant than it had ever been before. So that 20% that they're going to save over this time is going to be enough to cover the next 7 years. So it's phenomenal harvest. Now, before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph named the first Manasseh. And the name Manasseh means making to forget. This was the opportunity. Joseph gave him that name so he could forget about all the bad that had happened to him, that his brothers had sold him into bondage, that he had been in prison for a period of time. He named him Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. He named the second Ephraim, and Ephraim means fruitfulness. For he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So he's forgetting what lies behind, and he's looking forward to what lies ahead and what has already happened, the fruitfulness. When the 7 years of plenty, which had been in the land of Egypt, came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said, then there was famine in all the lands. But in the land of Egypt, there was bread. I like that. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, you shall do. And when the famine was spread over all the face of the earth, then Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. They didn't just get it free. He sold it back to them. Joseph opened all the storehouses, sold to the Egyptians, and the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. And the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the earth. And we're going to stop there, because the next chapters tie into another important part of the story.